Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode, Basic Folk. This is a very quick one. It's Cindy. This is where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. Last week, our guest was Erin McCune. We talked extensively about her group that she had from the late 90s to the early 2000s called Voices on the Verge, and it was like a real deep dive into folk nerddom in that time period. So I asked if people wanted to hear it, and like four people were like, yes, I want to hear it. And that was enough for me. So if you are familiar, Voices on the Verge were a group of four singer-songwriters, Erin, Jess Klein, Rose Polanzani, and Beth Amsell. And they had one record that came out on Ryko Disc called Live from Philadelphia, which I think it's available on Amazon. You can stream it on Amazon. I'm not sure if it's on Spotify, but it is out there. So please enjoy Erin and I nerding out to naming every single person in the underground folk scene. And I will play a clip. This is one of Erin's songs called Blackbird that was done by Voices on the Verge. Again, Jess Klein, Beth Amsell, Rose Polanzani, and Erin McCune. Please enjoy.
4 and 20 blackbirds to bake themselves to care. Fly away, you dainty dish. 2 blackbirds flew upstairs.
Okay, Voices on the Verge. Does anyone ever ask you about Voices on the Verge anymore?
Actually, yes. I just got a text the other day from Jess Klein, who I occasionally stay in touch with, asking a writer from No Depression had contacted her to talk about Voices on the Verge. I'm assuming a kind of where are they now type of thing. And Jess was like, are you open to this? Are you interested? And I was like, yeah, totally. And I haven't heard anything back.
Ah, well, I hope that comes together, because I think a good amount of people know Voices on the Verge. Can you talk about the intention behind that collaboration and what it meant to you at the time?
Do you really think a good amount of people know about Voices on the Verge?
I do.
I'm so curious your evidence
really
for this.
I really do. Well, when I went to Pittsburgh, that was, I think, like, so Rose Polanzani was my roommate when I lived in Somerville for the first time. And when I moved to Pittsburgh, I was looking for like a point of reference to talk about her. And they knew Voices on the Verge, like the DJs at WYP knew Rose from Voices on the Verge. And it was on like Ryko Disc, right?
Yes.
From Philly.
We made a record on Ryko Disc that, if I'm not mistaken, came out about 6 weeks after September 11th.
Ooh.
Yeah. And we did our last tour in the very early months of 2002. And so the project ran from like, I think like 1997 or so to like early 2002. And I mean, I think the intention behind it, I had met Rose through a friend of a friend, and I met Rose through a mutual friend in Chicago. That's how I met her. We both had a mentor named Andrew Calhoun, who runs a
Waterbug,
label.
Waterbug, right?
Exactly, Waterbug. And I had
met
Rose.
That's the label that Aeneas's Hymns for the Exiled came out on.
Yes, we were all sort of found by Andrew Calhoun.
Yeah.
I met Andrew at Falcon Ridge Folk Festival in 1996. He saw me playing, and we hit it off. And I lived with him in Chicago for a summer. And during that summer, an intern at his label. And that summer, he introduced me to Rose, who was another singer-songwriter that he had spotted and thought was great. And so that's how we became friends. And I think we certainly pointed him towards Aeneas or something in that. I can't remember exactly how I met Aeneas, but it was around that time. But Rose and I eventually got my first manager, who was also Rose's manager and who was also Jess Klein's manager. And he, I think, was thinking strategically and thinking like, oh, I can get one gig and put three of my clients on it. And the fourth person was Beth Amsell, who was managed by Charlie Hunter at the time, who was Dar Williams' first manager. I can't believe anyone would be possibly interested in this.
Keep
but anyway,
going.
That's how the four of us.
I'm interested.
That's how the four of us got together. and it was very casual at first. It might have been even at something ancient called the Fast Folk Cafe in New York, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, yeah. Fast Folk. Those compilations that
exactly.
came out.
Exactly. I remember running into those compilations like early in college. And that's how I heard Katie Curtis, I'm Not Radical, was on a Fast Folk compilation.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, God, get that song. That's amazing. But
wait, hold on. Isn't Fast Folk the scene? So Don Landis was in the Fast Folk scene for a second. I can't remember the name of the guy that ran it, but it was like he would have these like potlucks.
Right,
at
it was
his
a dude.
House.
Yeah.
And like Suzanne Vega, I think, was the most
Correct.
Famous person in that scene.
I can't remember his name either, but and I didn't know or remember that Don was part of that scene. I met Don as the sound person at the Living Room.
I think that you and I could write the folk Wikipedia.
But who would want to read this? This is my question.
You and me.
Okay. the first gig was like, we didn't have any plans to do things together, but all four of us were just gregarious, excited young musicians, and especially the other three really loved to sing harmonies. Like, I didn't have a lot of experience with that, but I had experience with playing like guitar on top of other people's music. So it just, the first gig, we just sort of jumped on each other's shit, and it was really fun and people really liked it. And so that eventually became codified into Voices on the Verge, which took up, I think, all of our lives for a certain period of time. And then we all decided it was time to go back to our own thing.
So from my perspective, I don't know what it was like for you. You probably have a better point of view on this than I mean, obviously you do. The early 2000s were a really weird time for women in music. Was there any kind of like, did you get any, like, looking back, do you feel weird about that time when it comes to being a female in the music industry?
I don't have a memory of that, which probably means like something traumatic was happening and I can't possibly like contain. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't mean like something personal traumatic was happening to my body at that time, but I think sort of, I think I just had my head down and I was working really hard and was really concerned with the minutia of like this gig or that song or who was going to be my agent or like that record label. And I don't think that I know there's always weirdness being a woman in the music business. I think what I would think reflecting on that question now is like, and I was thinking about this the other day, actually, like when I think about that time, I think about Norah Jones and I think about how amazing it felt to have Norah Jones get so popular. Because she's felt like such a unique and grounded and real artist. And I remember meeting her at the time and just loving the contrast between, like, she made such like chill, sweet, beautiful music and then was such an energetic, like, you know, swearin' sailor, like, you know, kind of person. And then she would just make this chill music. But I remember just loving that, like, real songs by like a real person were kind of blowing up the way they were blowing up. And I remember thinking that that was an important moment for women in the music industry. And what I had hoped is that Norah Jones, to me, represented a unique and singular artist who was doing their own thing. And lo and behold, people really liked it. And what I hoped is that the music business would look at that and be like, let's look for other unique and singular, authentic women artists who are doing their own thing and open the door for them. And instead, the music business did what it always does, which is then make a clone of 15 Norah Joneses. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's what I think. And I don't think there's anything unique about that as opposed to now. I mean, I think like something gets successful and then it gets sort of rubber stamped.